You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
I'm Daniel Wolf. I co-lead our work here on harm reduction, international harm reduction development, and we support work in most of, maybe all of the countries featured. I guess I should say in introducing that this is not meant to be an exhaustive catalog of all the ways that methadone is used in the world, but it is a very useful and insightful catalyst for conversation about how methadone is used and how it could be used. And so I hope we'll continue that after the movie is over. So I just wanted to acknowledge the two co-directors. And actually, I'm going to ask them, one of them, Helen, will be on the panel, but I'm going to ask them both just to introduce themselves to you now.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming. My name is Marilena Marchetti, co-director of the film. And I guess that's all you need to know about me for now. So thank you for coming.
Hi. Yes. My name is Helen Redman, and I'm the other co-director. I'm also a licensed clinical social worker, and I've been working with people who use drugs for well over a decade and ended up working with a lot of people who were using heroin, and one of my jobs was to help them to get into methadone. I'm also a journalist, and I write about drugs for the website Filter. So thank you all for coming, and please stick around, because we really want to get your feedback on the film. We really believe art should be interactive, and it isn't just what we say, but we really want to know. We know there's a lot of expertise in this room. So thanks again for coming.
Yeah, and my thanks to both of you and to all of you for coming. Just to note that our third panelist will be David Frank, who actually has some lived experience of methadone. So we don't want to privilege one form of expertise over another, but I do see in the room quite a number of people here who have either been prescribers or patients or people who have worked with prescribers and patients, so I'm looking forward to the conversation. And with that, we will begin. Before we get to the conversation, actually, David, you weren't here at the beginning. Would you mind introducing yourself for us?
Okay, yeah, my name is David Frank. I'm a sociologist who studies drug use, particularly opioids, overdose, and in particular, methadone maintenance. I'm currently a postdoc at NYU. I'm also a person who uses drugs, particularly opioids and heroin and methadone. And I've been on methadone maintenance for probably about 18 years now. Yeah, nice to see you all.
Thank you. And Helen, you introduced yourself at the beginning, but maybe let me just start with a question for both of you. So, you know, in discussing illegal drugs, we often talk about drug set and setting as important. And one of the things I really appreciate about the film is it makes it so clear that actually the setting and the set, in some sense, determines the efficacy also of medication, though we hardly ever talk about that. David, first question is for you. So you mentioned using methadone and then and other opioids, and a few people in the film talked about, quote, using on top or, you know, topping up. Some other people in the film, like people in the film, were mixed about whether or not, you know, the aims of treatment. What for you is the aim of treatment?
I mean, that's a great question. A complicated question. For me, the most, I guess the easiest answer, and this is, I think, a big misconception about methadone. I didn't get on methadone to get off of drugs or to get off of opioids. I got on methadone maintenance because of external pressures having to do with the war on drugs or heroin's illegality. I mean, sometimes I say, only half kidding, that I got on methadone maintenance to get access to opioids outside, actually not kidding at all. I got on methadone maintenance to get access to opioids outside of the war on drugs. It was really, I realized early on, that I loved opioids and I wanted to live my life using them. I functioned very well on them, but I realized that was just not happening under the system. And as the years wore on and the pressures of criminalization added up, I eventually, not that I realized it all at the time, but I realized I was going to have to find some way that I could do this legally every day. And that's what methadone was to me. I think it's a treatment for the war on drugs more than a treatment for addiction.
Okay, so Helen, you traveled around the world, and so you've seen lots of incarnations of the war on drugs. I guess for you, what struck you as, so Portugal is probably the quote most liberal place you went in terms of the criminalization regime. So I think many of you know you can have up to 10 days worth of any drug in Portugal without criminal penalty, although you do have to see one of those guys, the guy who said the thing about Wi-Fi. You have to go see someone like him, and he'll tell you about drugs and their potential dangers. If you were making changes to the system in any country that you went, what changes would you make? Like, what changes would you make to Portugal, for example, or do you think they got it right?
Okay, can people hear me? Okay. So I think the thing in making the film and then in editing and looking through all the footage that just kind of stood out was how the U.S. system has been exported around the world to a greater or lesser degree. And countries have modified the sort of, you know, U.S. model. That was a thing that felt very depressing, that other countries weren't able to really break out of a clinic system. And in Britain, which, I mean, I think the pharmacy is actually the best model, because everybody goes to a pharmacy, right? They're community hubs, people buy groceries there, makeup, all of that. But then the problem, and we call this liquid handcuffs light, is the supervised consumption at the pharmacy. So if they find another way to control you. In Portugal, I've been there a bunch of times, and they're really trying to evolve their system, but it's the same thing, right? You're going to a van 6 days a week, and then you can scale back. And there's no country that has it on prescription, and I think that is what the film, we want people to take away from it. We want prescription parity, and we want clinics to close. They are a relic of another era. They are not what, it is not the way that we should be providing methadone to people in the 21st century, especially, and everybody here knows this, we have an opioid overdose crisis and people can't get methadone. So prescription parity.
Okay. I actually am so aware of the enormous amount of expertise in the room. I see people here like Ernie Drucker, who was a pioneer of methadone at Montefiore, or Bruce Trigg, who helped get one of the first methadone programs in jail, or Marie, who has great expertise on systems of substitution treatment in France, or Howard Josepher, who ran a pioneering program, or Graham, who's done so much work, and Sharon Stancliffe. So there is like a huge amount of expertise in the room. If it's okay with you guys, I actually want to open it up for questions or statements. If you wouldn't mind keeping it brief, one of the things we all know, especially about drugs, is that people have a lot to say, but since there are a lot of people in the room, I've asked the holders of the microphone to grab it back if you go on too long. But if you wouldn't mind indicating if you have something to say, and maybe we'll take a couple of questions and statements and then turn back to the panelists. So yeah, just raise your hand. Yeah, please, here in the front.
My name is Gordon Skinner. First off, thank you to the filmmakers and certainly to OSF for hosting this. My question is, from your perspective, who is your audience and who is your audience not? And what is the pushback that you're receiving from either one of those two positions? They're not diametrically opposite, but they do inform the direction, the tenor, and the scope of your film.
Okay, great. Let's take a couple more questions and then come back, but that's an excellent question.
Hi, my name is Ernie Drucker, and I started a methadone program at Montefiore Hospital in the Bronx in 1968 with 1,000 patients that I ran for 30 years. And in that time, heroin users and crack users, who were most of those who were involved in it, had the ability to get the methadone easily, It was paid for by the state. And I was impressed in this movie that it touches all the different points that need to be touched about the complications, not just of the system for dealing with drug use, but drug use itself, because at the base of all this is the reason people use drugs is because they want to feel better about themselves and about life with those drugs. And the fact that it doesn't work out that well is like people driving cars that don't have steering wheels. Cars are a good thing to have, though, and drugs are a good thing to have. And the medications that have taken the place of some of the opiates, for example, that methadone represented in my own 30 years of experience with it, was very impressive to see when it was readily available. People used that as the platform for their own well-being. And, for example, none of our patients got HIV while on the program over the course of many, many years. So it seems to me that the movie and the issues that it raises at every level are really worth putting into a framework where all of us who were interested in this, including the patients and their families, could have the ability to meet about this and discuss it and come out with an approach to these issues from the point of view of the users and their families who, in other words, the criminalization that's the basis of the war on drugs has made it impossible to do what needs to be done with drugs because the whole world has used drugs forever. Animals use drugs. And we ought to be able, if we could, and I wanted to ask Daniel about this, if Soros Foundation would sponsor the creation of a working group based on this kind of discussion and these issues that would meet regularly and chew on these issues and come out with solutions of different parts or at least proposals about them. That's the next step in this. It's take this movie very seriously. I'm very impressed by it. And because it touches all the bases that need to be touched. And they can't be ignored. I'm personally involved in the work on these hemp-based drugs, CBDs. And I'm going to work with the people in Florida who manufacture it and to see if we can get the right use of CBDs to help people manage their opiate use or their methadone use. None of that's been done. Likewise with marijuana, the legalization of marijuana. I was the first person in New York State to get a medical marijuana pass out of the state. And I had injured my leg and I was using CBD in combination with it. So, and there's a lot to be done. I think we have access to actual solutions. And the war part of it is relevant, but there are, we win the wars, we lose wars, we settle them, we don't. And that's what could go on here. And I think this movie and the work of people like Daniel and others who have here at Open Society over the years have been able to at least discuss this freely. And maybe we can structure it in some way that it becomes a working group that's going to solve these problems. And because minimize the criminality of it, use the new medications that are available, and record that. Give the whole premise that people shouldn't use drugs, of course, is the failure of this. It's not true. People are using these drugs because we live in a world full of contradictions and things in anxiety that you can't deal with if you're just a mere human being. And these drugs are meant by people to help deal with that. And I think they can be developed to get by the psychopathology of our social structure, the injustice of our social structure that is the norm. So I think it can be a very positive outcome.
Thank you. And we'll come back later. And actually, I'm interested in your suggestion of the working group, but it also goes to the first question about like who gets to craft the solutions and who decides what the solutions are. So I think we had a colleague here. Yeah, please.
So I guess I would say this is contrarian, but I think this film should be for people who aren't experts in the field it should be informative, and I felt it utterly failed to do that. It was really confusing to me. It was not well made. I didn't understand. I don't know what methadone does, really. I don't know why it's good or why it's bad. I don't know what its effect on people is. And I've, you know, I think I've spent some time with Louis shooting him, and he was an active user at that time, and he's functional, so I understand that idea, but I felt the film was really unclear in what it was trying to accomplish and what it's suggesting as a solution.
All right. So let's actually go to the panelists. Oh, let's take one more question, then we'll go to the panelists.
Hi, I just had one thought in regard to the power dynamics. So I work at an opiate treatment program, and I thought it was really important that they shed light on the power dynamics between staff and clients. And I would be curious in terms of how we can try for some balance in those power dynamics, and also note that, let's say, in New York City, there aren't many methadone clinics, so how do we also raise awareness, and also in the same vein, make sure that patients' voices are being heard, even though there isn't much accessibility.
Thanks. So over to you guys. So a range of questions. Who's the film for and not for? And we had, on the one hand, a methadone expert saying it touched on all the right points, and someone who said he didn't understand sort of the basic points or premise. The power dynamics in the clinic. And then Ernie's point about a working group, like who can work out solutions? And I guess I would put it to you guys to answer any of those in any way that you want. But I am curious, particularly curious about the who's it for and not for, and also the who do you think holds the solutions? Like I take the point about abolishing the clinics, but like, yeah, where does the power to make positive change lie? So David.
Which is the question?
Anyone you want.
Anyone you want. Who's it for? Power dynamics in the clinic. Who has the power to make change?
The power dynamic. Well, I mean, I think, you know, there are some big answers, which are, abolish the clinic system. And I do think that's number one. I think maybe even, well, actually a bigger one is legalization and regulation of drugs, I think. And as we mentioned, this idea that people shouldn't be taking drugs at the bottom of all this. But more sort of pragmatic solutions. You know, why do we got to see a counselor every month? I've seen so many in my 18 years, and it's just a total crapshoot. Some of them have been really cool. Some of them have been horrible. Almost all of them have been very uneducated about drug use. That would be one way of getting rid of the power dynamic, because that's how it's mostly expressed, I think, is through the counselor relationship. That's usually the point of contact. And yeah, you get some, I mean, they have so much power. That's so much power. I mean, they could tell you to do what, I've been told to go to NA. I've been told to go to church. I've been told to volunteer in my community. Yeah, they got a lot of power.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because it's something that I've seen when I've been in methadone clinics, and people have told me about who have been on methadone. And I don't want people who work in methadone clinics, I hope that they are not offended by this film, although I think some people who work in clinics will feel that. And there is this horrible power dynamic, and I don't actually think there are many ways to change that power dynamic. I think the clinic system, as long as it exists, you can do some reforms here and there, but I don't think that is the way, and I think the only way is to end the clinic system. I think what happens, it isn't just in methadone clinics, it's in all institutions. What happens to people who work inside of a system where there is that horrific power imbalance, as Erin O'Malley, Omara said, and that is, if you stay in it long enough, you come to accept the urine talks, the mandatory counseling. If you're late, you don't get medicated. You end up accepting that. And I've seen that over and over again. And I had a student who told me a story about when she worked in a methadone clinic, and somebody was late and the door was closed, because if you miss the medication window, That's pretty much it. And this person smashed the glass. It was a glass door, and smashed through the door. And when she was telling me this, I was thinking about the person who was doing that, but I was thinking about the staff who were on the other side of the door. What happened to those people, the staff, that they wouldn't open the door, that they wouldn't say, this is so fucked up that we're not letting this person in. We have to change this, right? And this is what happens to people when you work in institutions where abuse becomes normalized, in prisons and jails, in psychiatric institutions. And it's really troubling to me. Again, I think people who work in methadone go in with the best of intentions, but that structure changes you. In order to survive and do your job and do the paperwork and you know the talk screen, that means you go back to 6 days a week. If you don't do it, what do you still have your job? You know, so I understand the constraints that staff is under. So that's why I feel like the clinic system, it has to go.
So the question of who the film is for or not for?
It's for everybody. It's for everybody. Unfortunately, we are still in the midst of an opioid overdose crisis that is touching hundreds of thousands, not only the people who have overdosed and died and overdosed and survived, but their families, their community. So we want everybody to see this film. We started with the harm reduction community because that's our fam, and we wanted to get the input about the film and go back and look at it and make edits. So we started with the harm reduction family, but we are going to NIDA at the end of this month, the National Institutes on Drug Abuse, and we're doing a screening there, and Nora Volko is going to be watching this film, and we're going to make the argument at NIDA about abolishing clinics. And to the point about the working groups and all of that, I think what we're thinking about right now is we actually have to build a movement, an advocacy movement, that is explicitly political and is made up of people who are on methadone, people who were on methadone, allies, family members, basically anybody who wants to. And we're not naive enough to believe that this isn't going to be a hell of a fight, because there are financial interests that are invested in the clinic system. There's ideological, investment in continuing the clinic system. There's the DEA, right? They won't even do methadone vans, right? So we're not naive to believe it's not going to be a hell of a fight, but we believe it's a fight worth having. This is a system that has to go. We have to be able to get, people have to be able, it has to be easier for people to get methadone than heroin in this country.
So I see a number of hands.
Feel free to disagree with all of that.
And the first hand I want to call on is Marilena, who's a co-director of the film since. Oh, you were playing with your hair. Never mind. In the middle, please, Sharon. Let the record show that if you were playing with your hair, you would have been able to talk. No, battery dead.
Delighted to finally hear David Frank. Been a long time. I'm Sharon Stancliffe. I used to be medical director of a methadone clinic in Harlem, and I now, one day a week, prescribe buprenorphine in a shelter, a federally qualified health center, so primary care. And I just want to bring up a few points about the science. The science says counseling really doesn't do very much for people. I have, and I love counseling. I bet everybody in this room has been in counseling. But in terms of mandatory counseling, there's nothing that says that helps. The second thing is, there's this, I guess, premise that if you are using other drugs and you get to take home your methadone or buprenorphine, you're selling that in order to get the other drugs. It's probably true some of the time, I don't know. But there's nothing. There is federal regulations about methadone, but there's nothing in buprenorphine that says I have to make my decisions about giving everybody a month's supply when they come to my primary care clinic based on the other drugs they're taking. But the fear I see and the like, gee, it looks like you dipped your buprenorphine in your urine because there's nothing there, but we check for the metabolite. And they're like, but I thought you'd throw me out of the clinic. It's like, no, but if you're taking fentanyl, I'd like you to know. I mean, it can be. I don't like urine testing, but it's kind of standard, so it's hard. And the third thing I want to say, I love the idea of the work group. I mean, I don't think we can abolish the clinics because methadone is a medicine, is not a moneymaker. And if I were given a choice, I would choose methadone over buprenorphine if a country could only have one or the other, I think. I think it's probably the better medicine, but there's no money in it. Not to say I love the clinic system, but I think, you know, I've heard from former federal officials it's time to relook at the regulations. I really think that a coalition of former government people, maybe, well, right, you know, eventually current government people that might change, people that have the experience, is a really good idea. Ernie?
Yeah, hi, Bruce Trigg. I was a methadone medical director in New Mexico for a while, and now I do consulting mainly on buprenorphine. So what Ernie Drucker didn't mention is that he did a study that I was involved with in New Mexico, where stable people who were on methadone were referred to a primary care clinic after a year, and they had a social worker who coordinated their care, and they picked up their methadone at a pharmacy. And people loved it, and the outcomes were excellent. And he repeated that we're in Pennsylvania as well. And nothing ever came of it, in part because I think people thought buprenorphine was going to be the solution. But we know that for a complex condition, it's good to have two medicines, and they both have certain strengths and weaknesses, but we know from experience in the United States that we could do an office-based opioid treatment that would get people out of this endless cycle of spending years and years going every day to clinics.
So let me ask you guys, because I have a fear, I will confess that I have a fear when you show this film to NIDA, that they will say, well, luckily, that's why we have buprenorphine. And not only that, that's why we have long-acting formulations. And in fact, if you're so interested in freeing people from the clinic, why don't you give them one of these formulations, either an opioid blocker like naltrexone or one of the new buprenorphine implants or injectables that will make them only come back once a month or once every 3 months or et cetera. So, you know, what would you say to someone who said, why bother with methadone at all? Let's just go to buprenorphine or naltrexone.
Me? Yep.
Sure.
Yeah. And I do want to point out, I'll save my 28-day comment, but remind me, I just mentioned something about 28-day clinics. You know, I think it goes back to this giant misconception about why people get involved with methadone. And you know, it gets very complicated when you talk about the medical model and the disease model, and sometimes it could be a good thing and sometimes it could be a bad thing, but this idea so dominates the way we think of problematic drug use that we almost forget about the fact that these are kind of oppressed citizens who are experiencing structural legal harm that accounts for a lot of their harms, and that is a lot of why they go to these clinics. And you know, like, again, this idea of like a blocker, like that's the last thing I want. Like I want to feel my methadone. That's why I go there. That's why, you know, that's the whole point, is I want my opioids. Not that I don't want my opioids. So yeah, I think there's this, you know, I think we need a critical assessment of the idea of addiction as the sole way we understand all of this, because it's really lacking. And we need to look at more pragmatic ideas of why people who use illegal drugs experience problems and how particularly substitution treatments function in that context. Right now, whenever anyone says like, oh, you're swapping an illegal drug for an illegal drug, that's perceived as a bad thing, and I understand it's mostly used as a bad thing, but it also illuminates this idea that yes, my problem isn't the pharmacology of heroin, it's that you all make it illegal and won't get off my back. So yeah, I swapped an illegal drug for a legal drug, and therein was the solution. Ah, thank you. There are very few and far between clinics. Montefiore in the Bronx is one of them, where you can get 28-day take-homes if you're considered a model patient. And somehow I wormed my way into that qualification years ago and have been grandfathered into it. And so now I only go once every 28 days to pick up my methadone. I don't see a counselor. I see a doctor who's aware that I'm not abstinent, but is also aware that I'm doing really good on this program. So there are ways of like letting some light into the system, and we can maybe expand on some of those.
Naltrexone, the injections are, did you say they're trying to work on an implant or
so for naltrexone? They have an implant in Australia, and they're, NIDA just gave a $2.7 million grant to someone to develop the implant also in the U.S. But there are buprenorphine implants and injections also, yeah.
Right, the naltrexone is incredibly expensive. So if you're talking about, you know, there's no money to be made and, you know, it's like, why are they finding money and a lot of money because it's on patent to do research around naltrexone when we have a medication, when we have methadone, which is inexpensive and, what, 40, 50 years of studies that show it's the gold standard. And what I would say to NIDA, if that does come up, it's like, we can talk about naltrexone, we can talk about buprenorphine, but we have to talk about the methadone clinic system because that's what the majority of people are getting for opioid substitution, although a new study just came out showing once again that far too few people are on these medications. And that's because of a lot of what David was talking about, discrimination, stigma, going every day. And people are horrified. I mean, I would put a challenge out to anybody here who believes that we need to keep the clinic system. I want you to take the methadone challenge and go to a clinic 6 days a week for a year. See what happens to your life, right? The other thing about methadone clinics is, you know, the NIMBY, not in my backyard, the fierce resistance to having methadone clinics in communities. And also, the other big problem with methadone, this is all outside of the clinic, is the drug dealers who set up pill mills outside of methadone clinics. They know where they are. They know they essentially have a captive audience. And they know that people are coming there who are still vulnerable to relapse and maybe want some benzos or maybe want, you know, some Suboxone or whatever. And that is the other value in getting rid of the clinics is you get rid of the NIMBY. No one's saying, I don't want those people in my neighborhood. They tried to get a methadone clinic opened in Harlem and the community rallied against it. It's gone when you don't have a clinic system. The drug dealers, well, I don't know, maybe they'll set up in front of CVS. Good luck, right? Those are just two more reasons, very powerful reasons, I think, to really rethink abolishing methadone clinics. Did I answer that?
Yes, you answered it.
Right. I will tell that to Nora Volko later this month.
Good luck.
So I know I see another hand here, and I don't know if there's anyone else who wants to make an intervention, but so here and here.
Hi, I think I'm the youngest person out here. So basically, my name is Zuzanna Skolimowska. I am still a high school student, but I'm very into politics. And I don't come from New York. I don't come from the States, not even from North America. And I would like to make a comment that the movie was actually really, really informative. And it will definitely support my project later this year and for my global politics higher level course. So thank you so much. And it was a really, really great job.
Thank you. And can I ask you where you do come from?
I'm from Poland, born and raised. I moved to Canada alone at the age of 17. I'm living in Sherbrooke, Quebec on my own. But here I am.
Welcome.
So if the film is an advocacy piece, I think that one of the, by virtue of the compare and contrast by other countries that you've illuminated, one of the things that I would hope to have a deeper dive into would be those individuals like David, as self-professed being a functional user, because that, aside from the power, rank, and privilege dynamics that, you know, exist between the user and the clinic, we also have to then take into account class and race and how that informs access and how that informs a lack of access, and how those systems are in place or designed to, one, keep an individual on a drug, and why those drugs and why those clinics are in areas that are not accessible or that are not in the eye. You're not going to see a methadone clinic on Fifth Avenue, on Madison Avenue, on Park Avenue. But you will see one in Bushwick. You will see one in East New York. And so what does that look like? How does that play itself out? And what are the, what's the conversation that we need to have and the conversations that we're not having that prevent them from being more visible in a manner that actually becomes proactive and empowering?
Thanks. And I think actually that's a good question to end on, which is, David, you mentioned the 28-day carries if you're lucky enough or skilled enough to maneuver the system.
Sure.
So I'm curious both how you do it, but also to what extent do you think that things like class, race, education play into like how the clinic treats you once you're there?
I mean, you can't overstate it. It plays into everything. I mean, I'm a sociologist, of course, I'm going to say that. But yeah, I mean, it's totally obvious into who, the one that gets written most about is who gets funneled into bup as opposed to methadone. But it happens in everything. I mean, in the minutia much more. I mean, I would, just to use myself as an example, there's no way I would have been able to manage to convince these people to give me the 28 days, particularly since I am a drug user still, if I wasn't white and if I wasn't a graduate student, and then later a graduate of graduate students. There's you can't understate it. I'm super privileged, and I've managed to make my life on methadone a little easier because of it. It's still, I mean, my privilege aside, when I always fear if I have to leave from New York or if I have to go to another city. But yeah, I'll still be better off than the people who aren't white and the people who aren't, considered professionals, whatever. I mean, yeah, my methadone clinic, now they call me Dr. Frank. So, I mean, I'm super privileged. You can't overstate it. And it's gone a long way.
Helen, same question to you, not about getting 28-day carries, but about, like, class, race, privilege, and the interplay, both in the clinic and making the whole idea of methadone less stigmatized. Or more stigmatized, I guess, is really the point.
Yeah, I think some people here are familiar with the work of Dr. Helena Hansen at NYU, and she writes about who gets methadone and who gets Helena Hansen, right? I'm thinking somebody else. And so there's no question that race and class runs. It doesn't matter what you're looking at. I mean, I consider methadone healthcare, but if you look at all of healthcare, you see how race and class plays out. People of color don't get, listed for transplants at the rate that white people do. You look at the rates of disease, breast cancer, just go down the line. And I think this is pretty well known in terms of methadone and buprenorphine, who is getting it. And so if you're a person who is homeless, a person of color, you're disadvantaged in so many ways. How it's much more difficult for you to comply with the methadone regimen.
Yeah.
It's structural. So in order for you to comply with the onerous regulations that most clinics have in place, you're going to fall short. Whereas if you're white and you have more support, you're going to be able to get to that clinic. You're going to be able to get that Metro card. On every level, you can see how it breaks down by race and class. And for me, that's just one more reason to end the clinic system, because if all healthcare providers who have prescription capabilities can just write a prescription for methadone, I think we can make a huge dent in the racism and the classism. Not to say it'll go away entirely, because we know that. We know that, that with legalizing marijuana, we know that people of color still are arrested at higher rates. But it is a major fundamental reform, I think, that would break open and really challenge that racism if you could just get a prescription. I'll leave it at that.
So with that, we are now at time. Let me just offer thanks to both panelists. Really appreciate it.
Thank you all.
And also to all of you. I don't know if you have all signed up for, if you get notices about events at here at OSF, but please do sign up if you haven't. And thank you for coming.